2 Kings, we're going to start in chapter 4 tonight. 2 Kings chapter 4. We'll see if I can get two chapters done. I am not promising. I'm not in any way promising that I can do two chapters tonight because of I'm a little distracted here. So, as we've talked about, after the death of King Solomon, the nation of Israel, watch for it, it splits in two. There you go. You like the fine animal, many, we'll put it together, then we'll split it apart. We'll put it back together, we'll put it back. Okay, nation of Israel splits into two. The northern kingdom will be known as Israel from this point on, while the southern kingdom will become known as Judah. We've followed the events of the northern kingdom now as one dynasty follows another. Another set of kings takes over, and then a couple of sons after that take over. And we've watched all the way through, and now Jehoram, who is the son of Ahab, is the ruling king up north. And all during this time, which is a pretty bad time in the northern kingdom's history, they have gone into great wickedness. And during this time, there was a man on duty, the prophet Elijah. He's the one that God's going to be using. But Elijah's gone now, and now a new guy is on duty, the prophet Elisha. And we've been following some of the miracles that Elisha has been doing, and we pick it up in 2 Kings chapter 4. A certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elisha, saying, "Your servant, my husband, is dead, and you know that your servant feared the Lord, and the creditor is coming to take my two sons to be his slaves." Now, just a quick note. This phrase, the sons of the prophets, we've talked about that in the past couple weeks. There were these, we call them schools of the prophets, where there were guys kind of like in training to be a prophet. It's kind of like that idea. And so if you went to the school for prophets, then you were called one of the sons of the prophets. That's the idea. So one of these guys is married, and he dies. And the woman says, "You know, the creditor is coming. You know, my husband was not too good with finances. The credit card bills are stacking up." And in those days, this is what you would do if you couldn't pay your debts. Your family could be sold into slavery. That's what they would do. And so this woman is afraid that the banker is about to knock on the door and haul my kids off. And she's freaked. That teaches you to charge up those credit cards, I tell you. Verse 2. So Elisha said to her, "What shall I do for you? Tell me, what do you have in the house?" And she said, "Your maidservant has nothing in the house but a jar of oil." Now, don't think like 1040 oil, like change your car oil or anything like that. This is olive oil. Olive oil wasn't used, and might have been used a little bit for cooking, but mostly in ancient days, it was used for oil lamps. It was the fuel, oil. The olive oil was the fuel of the day, but it was used for things like lamps. And she says, "We don't got nothing in the house." Well, it was used for cooking because they would mix it up with flour and make cakes out of it, like pancakes and stuff like that. Waffles. Have waffles. You know, make waffles out of flour and oil. Yeah, you could do that kind of stuff, right? Did you ever make waffles on Saturday morning? Nobody makes? Not with olive oil. Well, that's true. Yeah, but you probably put a couple tablespoons of vegetable oil in there, you know. But okay, let's move on. I'm getting way majorly sidetracked. I will never get through two chapters at this pace. So she says, "We got nothing in the house but a jar of oil." Then he said, this is Elisha speaking, he says, "Go borrow vessels from everywhere. Get cups, bowls, everything. From all your neighbors, empty vessels. Do not gather just a few. And when you have come in, you shall shut the door behind you, you and your sons. Then pour it into all those vessels and set aside the full ones." So she went from him and shut the door behind her, and her sons brought the vessels to her, and she poured it out. That's kind of like one of those like magic tricks that the magicians do. She's pouring the oil, and it keeps pouring, and it keeps pouring, and it pours. And she puts another cup there, and it pours, it fills it up. And she puts a bowl there, and it fills up the bowl. She puts a big fish tank, it fills up the whole fish tank. And she just keeps pouring and pouring. And she poured it out, verse 6, "Now it came to pass when the vessels were full, that she said to her son, bring me another vessel. And he said to her, there is not another vessel. So the oil ceased. Then it finally stopped pouring it out. Then she came and told the man of God, and he said, go sell the oil and pay your debt, and you and your sons live on the rest. Now, this is kind of a miracle, by the way. I hope you got that. This is not just a magic trick. This is a miracle. It started with a little pot of oil, and they filled up all the cups and bowls and everything they could get their hands on, and they're all now filled with oil. They can sell it now and take care of the problem. What shall I do for you? This is a lesson here, my friends, about God's provision. We often like to quote this verse, Philippians 4:19, my God shall supply all your need according to his riches in glory by Christ Jesus. We like to quote that, especially when the bills are due, that my God will supply all our needs. The question is, how does this actually work? And I think, even though you can make a point this is just a one-time miracle, I think there are some principles here that we could probably learn some lessons from. For example, the principle of you use what you have. He doesn't say, what do you wish for, like a magic genie. He says, what do you got in the house? What do you have? She had a pot of oil. That's what they're going to work with. They're going to work with what you have. That's how it starts. You don't use some unknown thing, but something that was with them. There was this one story about Jesus. It's kind of a funny, freaky, weird story, where he and Peter had to pay some taxes. And they go through this whole discussion about the taxes. And finally, Jesus says to Peter, he says, nevertheless, lest we offend them, go to the sea, cast in a hook, catch the fish that comes up first, and when you have opened its mouth, you will find a piece of money. Take that and give it to them for me and you. And that's what happens. It's a freaky thing. He goes fishing and he catches a fish, and there's a coin in the fish's mouth. They call those little fishes now they call them in the lake, the Sea of Galilee. Now they call them St. Peter's fish. They're tilapia is what they are. And they got big mouths. They could fit a coin in them or something like that. And you'd think it's kind of a miraculous thing that a coin's in there. And maybe it is. But before you think about this being a completely strange miracle, let me ask you this. What was Peter's profession? What did he do for a living? He was a fisherman. Jesus didn't ask him to go play baseball. He didn't ask him to buy a lottery ticket. He told him to go to work. Think about that. When you think about this miraculous thing about paying their taxes, he told Peter to go to work. Now, there was a bit of a miracle with the coin in the fish. I get that. He only had to catch one fish, but he still had to go to work. But don't miss that point. Use what you have. Think of when you're thinking about God providing for you, sometimes we think it's going to be some miraculous thing. There's going to be a check in the mail. And sometimes there is. But think about what you have. Start with what you have. And work at it. They were told to gather up empty pots and not just a few. They didn't sit on the couch watching Gilligan's Island. Oh God, provide for me. Oh God. Oh, could you change the channel for me and say, well, let's now, Bewitched is on the other channel. Let's change it. Work at it. Paul wrote, for even when we were with you, we commanded you this, if anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. So, I know there's a miracle going on here, but they had to work for this. Don't miss that. There was a family secret. Did you notice that? They were supposed to do this behind closed doors. I think one of the ideas behind this is that it speaks about who the funds were to be for. They were to supply the needs of the family, not the whole city. We're not going to do this in the city square and then make oil for everybody. The whole goal here is to provide for this family. I think that's interesting. I think that's something here, that this provision was for the family. They were supposed to pay their debts with it. I have seen people through the years, because I've been doing this church stuff for a long time, and people get into debt all the time. and we're praying for them and we're asking for help. And sometimes when people who are in debt because they've made unwise decisions, and sometimes God comes through and gets them, and they're sitting with a check in their hand going, wow, where did this come from? And then they go out and they go have a party or go buy cookies for their friends or whatever. And you need to go pay your debts first. Take care of the debts. Paul wrote, owe no one anything except to love one another, for he who loves one another has fulfilled the law. When you work to get out of debt. I don't know if you've been in church hearing the announcements we're starting to make concerning the next session where there's of the servant school. We're going to, I think it's in about 2 or 3 weeks, we're going to start a new session. And one of the classes we're going to offer is called the Financial Peace University. It's a 9-week class. It's a class put together by Dave Ramsey. You might have heard him on the radio. He's on TV. He's actually a Christian. I don't know if you've picked up on that when you watch him on TV when he gives these financial advice. He's a strong Christian. And this isn't make-believe money. This is real practical principles that he'll be teaching. And one of the deals is he's gonna kind of put the screws on everybody. Look, figure out a way to get out of debt. You need to deal with your debts. You need to stop paying so much in credit card charges and all this kind of stuff. You got to work to get come up with a plan to get out of debt. And you conquer that, then you can start doing things with your money that you probably never thought was possible. But you got to get out of debt. Pay your debts. I know some of people might struggle with the fact that this particular class is $95. I've struggled with that because we try to do everything on the cheap. But you're buying his materials. That's his price. And actually, I've learned over the years that when people have to put up a few coins, they tend to show up. That's just kind of the way it works. You know, when people, on free things, people kind of tend to... So I know, if you want to be a part of the class and you can't quite make $95, talk to me. We'll try to work out something and we'll try to help you cover some of it. But think about it. I would love for us all to figure this out. It's a great deal. Great idea. Pay your debts. And also then, he says, live on what's left. After they paid their debts, they were supposed to live on what was left over. And the implication is that you don't live beyond what's left over. You don't decide, well, now I'm going to go out and buy a yacht. You can't buy a yacht. There will be enough to live on, but maybe not enough to buy all of the biggest flat-screen TV that you've ever wanted or something like that, but to learn to live on your means. Paul wrote in Philippians 4, verses 11 through 13, he says, not that I was ever in need, for I have learned how to be content with whatever I have. I know how to live on almost nothing or with everything. I have learned the secret of living in every situation, whether it is with a full stomach or empty, with plenty or little. For I can do everything through Christ who gives me strength. Now, we like that last verse. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. But think about the context. It's all about learning to live with what you have. Don't live with what you don't have. Don't try to build your life hoping that you one day be able to pay off this credit card thing that you just charged. No, learn to live within your means. That's how you stay out of trouble. And if you've been given X number of dollars, we learn to live within that X number of dollars. Or you get a better job or learn how to make more money so you can whatever. But don't live beyond your means. And that's kind of built into this principle that they're now told to live on what's left. Don't go building up the charges again. Don't go back into debt. Live on what you have, on what's left. And then the oil ceased, it said in verse 6. Now, I don't want to make too much out of this, but I like to go down rabbit trails. I spend too much time thinking about stuff. And I call a principle here this, making room for abundance. You can kind of build a case if you want to get all symbol-y and, stuff, give symbolic meanings to things. You could kind of make a case that clay pots are a picture of people. It's like us. We're like clay pots. I could show you some scripture that say we're like, actually most of us are more like cracked pots, but you could say that we're like clay pots. And oil is always, usually in the Bible, a picture of what? the Spirit, the Holy Spirit. I think sometimes the only thing that hinders us from seeing more of God's work in our lives is simply because we don't make room for it. I don't want to fault this woman and say, you know, shame on her, she didn't get more pots. I don't really want to go down that road. But did you notice that the pouring stopped when the vessels were filled? And the idea is the more vessels you have, the more space you make, the more room there is in your life, the more you're overflowed. Does that make sense? When you start thinking that you're full and that you've arrived, you're probably not in a good spot. There's a sense we ought to be hungering and thirsting. I want a little more of the Lord, because there is so much more. Ephesians 3:20. Now to him who is able to do abundantly above... Now to him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we can ask or think, according to the power that works in us. God can do more in your life than you can even imagine. And I wonder sometimes, I don't know if this is making any sense to you. Is this making any sense to you? I think sometimes we just don't make enough room for him in our lives. We crowd him out with a lot of stuff in our lives. And I wonder sometimes, this is an experiment I've been praying for this about 6 months. I think it's been about 6 months, been on my prayer list for myself. And it's because I finally decided to try one of Papa Chuck's things. You know, I've heard him tell us years and years ago about that he prays every morning that God would bless him and give him all that he's wanting to give him today. And when I first started praying that for myself, I kind of had a hard time. God, would you bless me? Oh, I don't like that. That just sounds selfish. You know, I don't know that I'm comfortable in saying that, because I certainly don't feel like I deserve to be blessed. And you know what? That's true. That's correct. I do not deserve to be blessed. That's a correct evaluation. But God doesn't want to bless me because I deserve it. This is what grace is all about. And the question is, am I opening myself up to be open to receive all that he wants to do in my life? Don't think paydays. Don't think the slot machine and all the money's coming out. That's not what I'm talking about. All that God wants to do in me is way more than stupid old money. Wisdom to handle the messes I'm in. To keep going through this difficulty I'm in. Maybe teachability to keep learning the lessons I'm supposed to figure out. Joy sometimes enters into it. Having God's joy in my life. Peace, I really want God's peace all the time. Sometimes, it's really funny, sometimes I wake up in the morning so stressed out. I haven't figured that out. It's been like last week, I wake up like, you know, 4 in the morning or something. I got all this stress for some stupid dream I cannot figure it out. Why am I all stressed? I want God's peace in my life all the time. I want more. And so I think it's a good idea to pray that. I challenge you to pray that. Make room for more, so that when the oil's being poured out, he can fill up everything that he's got. Verse 8. I don't think I'm going to make 2 chapters tonight. Now it happened one day that Elisha went to Shunem, where there was a notable woman, and she persuaded him to eat some food. That's not hard for anybody to persuade me. You know, would you have some food? Why, yes, ma'am, I would love to. She persuaded him to eat some food. So it was, as often as he passed by, he would turn in there to eat some food. Now let's look where Shunem is. Look at our map. Elijah apparently had like this circuit that he would run. He would go from Jericho to Bethel to Gilgal, the second Gilgal we've talked about, to Samaria, and up to Mount Carmel up here. Shunem is right here, kind of in the path of his tracking, and that's where it's at, in the Jezreel Valley, is where Shunem is. And so that's kind of where he meets this woman, and she's a notable woman. She was apparently wealthy. She was a very benevolent woman, great with hospitality. And you know what, friends? In the ancient days, there were no Motel 6s. So when you do a lot of traveling, you kind of are hoping that somebody will invite you over to their house, or else you got to learn to camp, you know, something like that. And so this woman, verse 9, she said to her husband, "Look now, I know that this is a holy man of God who passes by us regularly. I've seen this guy before. I've heard stories about the guy. Please," she says to her husband, verse 10, "please let us make a small upper room on the wall, and let us put a bed for him there, and a table, and a chair, and a lampstand, so it will be whenever..." Doesn't say about anything about the TV, so I guess he didn't get a TV. "So it will be whenever he comes to us, he can turn in there." And it happened one day that he came there, and he turned into the upper room and lay down there. Then he said to Gehazi, his servant, "Call this Shunammite woman." When he had called her, she stood before him. Now let's stop for a second. Just want to draw your attention. This is the first time we meet Elisha's servant. His name is Gehazi. We have talked often about how the idea of serving others is the heart of what ministry is all about. And we've also talked about how great men in the scriptures, the great leaders, all start out as servants. Joshua was the servant of Moses, and yet he would be the one who would come in and conquer the land. We've seen how Elisha was the servant of Elijah. That's how, before Elisha becomes this great guy, he was Elijah's servant. And now we see that Gehazi is like the next in line. He's like the next thing to be. He's on deck. He's, you know, he's coming out of AAA ball, about ready to hit the major leagues. It's, you know, spring training's about to hit. You know, what's he going to be like? Is he going to be, how's this guy going to turn out? We're going to find out in verse 13. And so he said to him, "Say now to her," this is what Elisha tells Gehazi, "say to him," or he said to him, "say now to her, 'Look, you have been concerned for us with all this care. What can I do for you? Do you want me to speak on your behalf to the king or to the commander of the army?'" She answered, "I dwell among my own people." Now, that's kind of a strange answer, but he's wanting to know, because he's got some influence. He's a guy that people talk to, the king, the head of the army. They know that Elijah is somebody. They're kind of shaking in their boots a little bit, and he could say some things. He could help her out, you know. And she says, "I dwell among my own people." In other words, "I'm good. You know, I'm good. I'm good with life just as it is right now. I'm good where I'm at. I'm okay." Verse 14, "So he said, 'What then is to be done for her?' And Gehazi answered, 'Actually, she has no son, and her husband is old.' So he said, 'Call her.' When he had called her, she stood in the doorway. Then he said, 'About this time next year, you shall embrace a son.' And she said, 'No, my lord. Man of God, do not lie to your maidservant.'" She said, don't you lie to me. Now, she has apparently had a lot of disappointment in life about this. This is a sore spot for her, that she's never been able to have kids. And she's had people give her false hopes. So don't you dare lie to me. Don't you be another one of these people that lie to me. You know, I've known people over the years who have difficulties of various kinds. And you know what? Some of us well-meaning people are very cruel to them. I remember one gal, she was our secretary for years at Calvary Anaheim. Her name was Lisa, and she was severely handicapped. Her job was to answer the phone. That's about all she could do. You know, in a wheelchair, quadriplegic, barely could write. But she was fine on the phone, and she would tell me these stories over the years about people who would come up to her and say, "I'm going to pray for you, sister. We're going to pray for God to heal you. Get up out of the chair." And it's just devastating to be hearing this stuff. it's a cruel thing to make promises that God hasn't made. And that's what she's saying. She said, don't you lie to me. Don't you go telling me this stupid stuff. But, verse 17, the woman conceived and bore, because this is not no ordinary guy, this is God's man, this is Elisha, and bore a son when the appointed time had come of which Elisha had told her. And the child grew. Now it happened one day that he went out to his father, this is the little boy, out to the reapers. It's out, you know, it's a fall, they're trying to reap the fields and stuff. Some have suggested the kid's like 6-7 years old. You'll see that kind of fits the story. And he said to his father, my head, my head. So the dad says to a servant, carry him to his mother. When he had taken him and brought him to his mother, he sat on her knees till noon and then died. And she went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God, shut the door upon him and went out. So she takes her dead son. And she takes him upstairs to Elisha's room and lays him out on Elisha's bed. Then she called to her husband and said, please send me one of the young men and one of the donkeys that I may run to the man of God and come back. The idea is that she's going to ride the donkey and there's going to be a young man that's going to be running, guiding the donkey. That's the idea. So he said, why are you going to him today? It is neither the new moon nor the Sabbath. Now, that's not like a movie, the new moon. It's not that. New moon or the Sabbath, and she says it as well. New moon, these are religious days for the Jews. These are days when you might want to go talk to the prophet. And it's kind of like her husband's thinking, you know, we only go to church on Christmas and Easter. This is not those days. What are you wanting to go to see that guy? What's this all about? He doesn't quite get it. You know, sometimes that happens, doesn't it? Sometimes the spouse just doesn't quite get it. You know, it's like, it's not new moon or Sabbath. Why would you go talk to him? You know? Then she saddled a donkey and said to her servant, drive and go forward. Do not slacken the pace for me unless I tell you. And so she departed and went to the man of God at Mount Carmel. Now, she's in Shunem, remember? Shunem is about 25 miles from Mount Carmel, which is up on the coast. So even if the kid who's driving the donkey is running, I'm sorry, I think it's going to take at least a day to get there and a day to get back. Maybe if this is some kind of ultra marathoner kid, maybe they could do it in a day. She could do it if she's riding the donkey, but most likely this is at least 2 days. The kid's laying dead for 2 days in Elisha's room before anything else happens. Get that in mind. That's kind of important to keep that in mind. So it was when the man of God saw her afar off that he said to his servant Gehazi, because see, he's in Mount Carmel, and he sees this woman on a donkey and going, look, the Shunammite woman. Please now run to meet her and say to her, is it well with you? Is it well with your husband? Is it well with the child? He's thinking, something must be wrong. It just doesn't feel right. And she answered, it is well. Now, that doesn't make sense. How could she say it's well when her kid's dead? He's been dead for the last 24 hours or 12 hours or whatever it's been. How can you say it's well? Because she's not talking to Elisha. She's talking to Gehazi, right? And I just got to just drop a little hint. I think maybe she didn't like Gehazi. You're going to see why in the next, as the next couple chapters unfold. Gehazi's a little sleazy. She wants to talk to Elisha. So she just tells Gehazi, oh, yeah, everything's fine. Now, when she came to the man of God at the hill, she caught him by the feet. But Gehazi came near to push her away. Woman, stop this. But the man of God said, let her alone, for her soul is in deep distress. And the Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me. You know, he's trying to push her away. And I got to admit that sometimes we kind of do that to people, don't we? We kind of push them away instead of letting them get what they need from God. Anyway. And he says, look, God hasn't told me what this is all about. Elisha was a man with an incredible gift, a spiritual gift. We could call this gift the word of knowledge. There's a spirit called the word of knowledge where God sometimes will give a person inside information about a person, a place, a thing, about something that's happened, even though they've never been there. We'd call that a word of knowledge. And in fact, it's so pronounced in Elisha's life that we're going to read later on in chapter 6. A guy was talking to one of the kings and said, none, my lord, because he wanted to know who's spying on us. And he says, none, my lord, O king, but Elisha the prophet who is in Israel tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom. I mean, talk about spies. I mean, how can you, you know, you don't need bugs or satellites or nothing like that. Elisha's just, you know, and this was to the king of Syria, 100 miles away. And he whispers in his bedroom, and Elisha is telling the king of Israel what's going on. Well, this is an amazing gift. But here, he's clueless. Elisha doesn't, he's going, I can't quite figure this out. I don't know what this is all about. I don't know if you realize this, but you don't know everything. Did you know that? Now, we probably are a little more aware of that than Elisha. But the truth is, you don't know everything. There's only one person that knows everything, and that's God. Yet he's the one who decides whether he's going to whisper something in our ear or not. Sometimes God just wants you to talk to the person. Sometimes we size up the situation. Oh yeah, I got this one. I've talked to them before. I know what this problem is. And we like, they haven't even said two words, and we're starting to fix the problem. You know what? Sometimes you just have to talk to them. Sometimes we begin to spout off what we think is the answer, and we really don't have a clue or a clue so. Pay attention.
Dad?
There's a reason for this.
Hey. My name is Professor Guy Gadbois, medieval castle authority for Marseille. Tell me, do you have a ring?
I do not know what a ring.
Zimmer.
Ah, a room.
That is what I have been saying, you idiot. Rim. Zimmer.
Now watch this carefully. This is the important part. See the dog?
Is your dog back? Oh. I thought you said your dad did not bite.
That is not my dog.
Sorry, I had a friend remind me of that scene last weekend. It fits. What's so funny about this scene is that Clouseau thinks the dog belongs to the man, right? And so it says, does your dog bet? And the man says, no. But the man's thinking of his dog was in the other room. And so he says, no. And Clouseau reaches down to pet the dog, and it bites him, and he's thinking, how good you, the dog bets. You know, and it's because he doesn't get the whole story. He doesn't understand. You don't know everything. And my friends, we got to keep reminding ourselves of that. We don't know everything. The Bible says, he who answers a matter before he hears it, it is folly and shame to him. Sometimes, my friends, ministry is much more effective when you sit down and just let them talk. And that's what Elisha's going to have to do. He's going to have to find out what's going on. He doesn't have instant, complete knowledge. He's going to have to listen. I don't think he has a problem with that. So she said, verse 28, did I ask a son of my Lord? Did I not say, do not deceive me? She's reminding him of this whole conversation they had a few years back. I told you, don't lie to me. Then he said to Gehazi, so he's kind of gathering something's wrong. He said to Gehazi, get yourself ready, take my staff in your hand, and be on your way. If you meet anyone, do not greet him, and if anyone greets you, do not answer him, but lay my staff on the face of the child. Gehazi is going to be sent to run to Shunem with the staff and to lay his stick on top of the child. Meanwhile, the rest of the group's going to, they're going to follow, but they're not going to be running, because I don't know that Elisha can run. I don't know. And the mother of the child said, "As the Lord lives and as your soul lives, I will not leave you." So he rose and followed her. So she's not going to leave Elisha until Elisha gets to be with the boy. Now Gehazi went on ahead of them and laid the staff on the face of the child, and there was neither voice nor hearing. Therefore he went back to meet him and told him, saying, "The child has not awakened." When Elisha came into the house, there was the child lying dead on his bed. He went in, therefore, shut the door behind the two of them, and prayed to the Lord, prayed to Yahweh. Just want to remind you, my friends, God uses people who pray. God uses people who are serious about prayer. And I'm not just talking about praying before you eat dinner. I'm not talking about a few sentences that you shoot up before bedtime. I'm not talking about some quick little prayer that you pray during the day. I'm talking about committed time in prayer. A fellow who knew a lot about prayer, his name is E.M. Bounds. He wrote lots of books on prayer. He knew a lot about prayer. And he writes this: "Much time spent with God is the secret of all successful praying. Prayer, which is felt as a mighty force, is the immediate product of much time spent with God. Our short prayers owe their point and efficiency to the long ones that have preceded them." You understand what he's saying? Sometimes it only takes a short prayer, but that's because you're a person who's learned to pray the long prayers beforehand. You're a person who's learned to spend time in God's presence. The short prevailing prayer cannot be prayed by one who has not prevailed with God in a mightier struggle of long continuance. Jacob's victory of faith could not have been gained without that all-night wrestling. God's acquaintance is not made by quick visits. God does not bestow his gifts on the casual or the hasty comers and goers. Much time with God alone is the secret of knowing him and of influence with him. He yields to the persistency of a faith that knows him. He bestows his richest gifts on those who declare their desire for and appreciation of those gifts by the constancy as well as earnestness of their prayers. In other words, spend time, give time to prayer. That's kind of like that making room in your life for God to work. Giving, and it's not something that you can do. You can't learn to pray hours on end tomorrow. Try 5 minutes tomorrow. Maybe try 5 minutes a day for a week. And then you'll find that maybe 10 minutes a day is not that hard of a deal. And keep stretching your prayer muscles. Spend time with God in prayer. What you're going to see here is an exercise in prayer by Elisha. Verse 34, "And he went up and lay on the child." When it says he went up, the idea is that he was laying down. He was flat on his face in prayer. Flat on his face. And he gets up and he lays on the child, put his mouth on his mouth, his eyes on his eyes, his hands on his hands, and he stretched himself out on the child, and the flesh of the child became warm. He returned and walked back and forth in the house, and again went up and stretched himself out on him. Then the child sneezed 7 times and the child opened his eyes. Now when it says he leaves the bedroom and he's walking back and forth, maybe he's still praying. I don't know. Maybe he's freaked out. I don't know what. But then he goes back and he lays on the child again and says, and the child sneezed 7 times. I don't know what that's all about. I was just like, boy, but it was enough. Somebody needed to write that down. 7 times. Achoo. Wow. Achoo. Oh, he sneezed twice. Achoo. Three times. Kid sneezes 7 times. Just a weird story. Weird story. And he, Elisha, called Gehazi and said, "Call this Shunammite woman." So he called her. And when she came into him, he said, "Pick up your son." So she went in, fell at his feet, and bowed to the ground. Then she picked up her son and went out. He was raised from the dead. Had to have been dead at least a day or two. Oh my gosh. And the fact that the flesh had to warm up, he was dead. Kid was dead. Oh my gosh. Verse 38. death stew. Ha ha, dun dun dun. And Elisha returned to Gilgal, and there was a famine in the land. Gilgal is about 40 miles south of Shunem. And so he's now back on his circuit. He's now gone back to the school at Gilgal. And when he arrives, there's famine in the land. There hasn't been a lot of rain. There isn't a lot of food around. Verse 38. Now the sons of the prophets were sitting before him, and he said to his servant, "Put on the large pot and boil stew for the sons of the prophets." So one went out into the field to gather herbs and found a wild vine and gathered from it a lapful of wild gourds and came and sliced them into the pot of stew, though they did not know what they were. Oh, danger. Then they served it to the men to eat. Now it happened as they were eating the stew that they cried out and said, "Man of God, there is death in the pot." And they could not eat it. There's death in the pot. This goes to show what happens when you send the wrong person shopping. The kid comes back with an apron full of bad stuff.
Green Bay Packer Clay Matthews is one of the most fearsome and accomplished linebackers in the NFL. The Super Bowl champion and two-time Pro Bowler terrorizes quarterbacks with reckless abandon. Fueled by exceptional speed, brute strength, and a knack for finding the ball. He also has a knack for finding the right products. Clay Matthews is one of the 45 million proud men known as today's male shopper. Clay approaches shopping with the same laser-like focus he brings to the gridiron.
Clay, what's going on?
Family's in town. Major restocking. What are you making tonight?
Yeah, the girls want lasagna, but I'm going for something healthier.
Try whole wheat noodle. Boom, aisle 6.
Nice.
Okay, enough of that. I was just the stupidest thing. I just was trying to think, could I find some goofy thing of a guy shopping? And turns out he is a serious shopper. Isn't that wonderful? Aren't you glad I just wasted a minute of your life? Okay, so, but not every guy's a bad shopper. Now, the guy that gets this stuff is a bad shopper. So, he said, verse 41, "Will then bring," this is what Elisha says when they say, "There's death in the pot." He says, "Then bring some flour." And he put it into the pot and said, "Serve it to the people that they may eat." And there was nothing harmful in the pot. Now, the point is that apparently a miracle took place. And something that was poisonous and was made edible. I don't know. It's a strange thing. Either that or else he just made gravy, because as he added flour to the thing and he made gravy, I guess. I don't know. Maybe that just needed a pot. Or I was thinking about the poison pot being a great picture of my life. I don't know about your life. My life's probably, I could identify with being a poison pot. And you add some flour, the manna, the bread of life, God's word. I think when you put a lot of God's word in your life, some of the poison gets soaked up. And God's able to deal with this. I don't know. That's just a strange thing. Verse 42. Then a man came from Baal Shalisha, which is someplace near Gilgal, and brought the man of God bread of the first fruits, 20 loaves of barley bread and newly ripened grain in his knapsack. And he said, "Give it to the people that," and he said, this is what Elisha says, "Give it to the people that they may eat." Now this bread of the first fruits, this is something this man is doing out of obedience to the law. It's harvest time, and he's going to bring the first part of his crop to offer it to the Lord. Keep in mind, gang, this is in a famine. So this is quite an extraordinary thing that the guy still wants to give something to God when it's in a famine. Most of us would say, "We're in a famine. I'm not giving nothing away. We're going to hold on to this stuff." But this guy is sharing. He brings his offering to the Lord. And Elisha wants to share it with the people. Verse 43, But his servant said, that must be Gehazi, what, shall I set this before 100 men? He said again, give it to the people that they may eat, for thus says the Lord, they shall eat and have some left over. So he set it before them, and they ate and had some left over according to the word of the Lord. Now Jesus fed 5,000. He's a little bit more heftier than Elisha. But Elisha apparently with this offering is feeding 100 men. And they ate and had some left over. And there's a principle, my friends, I think, that God is generous to those who are generous. The man who brings the offering is generous because, my gosh, it's a famine and he's still bringing this offering to the Lord. And Elisha is generous because he could hold on to it and said, oh, it's mine. I'm not sharing this. You know, I'm not sharing my Baby Ruth candy bars with nobody, you know. He could have been holding on to it, but he's not. He's sharing it. And in response, God feeds everybody with it. Look at the principle in Corinthians. I say this, he who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, but he who sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. So let each one give as he purposes in his heart, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loves a cheerful giver. And God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that you, always having all sufficiency in all things, may have an abundance for every good work. When we learn and we figure out, it's not an easy thing to figure out, but when we figure out to give as God is leading us, whether it's to a friend in need, whether it's to all kinds of things, however God would lead you to give, as you learn to give according to the leading of the Spirit, you're going to find that God's generosity will flow back on you as well. I think there's a good principle there. Chapter 5. Let's see if I can do chapter 5. Now Naaman, or Naaman, but I'm going to just say Naaman because I've been stuck on that, saying it that way for 50 years. Now Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, was a great and honorable man in the eyes of his master because by him the Lord had given victory to Syria. Those are the bad guys. God had given victory to Syria. He was also a mighty man of valor, but a leper. Now it says through him the Lord had given victory to Syria. Now, a few years back, Syria and Israel were in a big battle, and Syrians won. This was the battle at Ramoth Gilead. I don't know if you remember this. This is where King Ahab died. It was in the battle of Ramoth Gilead, and probably we think that Naaman was the guy in charge of this battle. During that battle, so there's an interesting thing. It says, "Now a certain man drew a bow at random and struck the king of Israel between the joint of his armor. So he said to the driver of his chariot, turn around and take me out of the battle, for I am wounded." And Ahab then ends up dying. It happens because a certain man draws a bow at random, and the Hebrew scholars think that certain man was Naaman. So whether it was or not, that's an interesting thought. And so when it says that by him the Lord had given victory to Syria, that kind of makes sense then, doesn't it? That because he was the guy that shot an arrow in the air, where it went, I knew not where, and then it kills Ahab. You know, it was a guided Ahab missile. I don't know. This guy is an awesome guy, but he was a leper. He was a leper. He had a huge problem. He had a skin disease, a terrible skin disease. And in those days, leprosy made you unclean, made you an outcast. It was incurable in those days. This guy has a mess of a life. Verse 2, and the Syrians had gone out on raids and had brought back captive a young girl from the land of Israel. She waited on Naaman's wife. So meanwhile, back at home, there's this young girl who's their slave girl. She's an Israelite girl, and she was working for Naaman. Verse 3, then she said to her mistress, "Oh, if only my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria." Who's who? Who's the prophet in Samaria? Elisha. Okay. "For he would heal him of his leprosy." And Naaman went in and told his master, saying, "Thus and thus the girl said, who's from the land of Israel." And the king of Syria said, "Go now, I will send a letter to the king of Israel." So he departed and took with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothing. We think this is about, it's like 750 pounds of silver, 150 pounds of gold. We're talking millions of dollars and a bunch of clothes. You're going to pay for this. Then he brought the letter to the king of Israel, which said, "Now be advised when this letter comes to you that I have sent Naaman my servant to you that you may heal him of his leprosy." This is the way the guys read. This is the way the king of Israel is reading this letter. You heal my servant. And what happened when the king of Israel read the letter, that he tore his clothes and said, "Am I God to make, to kill and to make a lie that this man," talking about the king of Syria, "that this man sends a man to me to heal him of leprosy? I mean, that's impossible. Therefore, please consider and see how he seeks a quarrel with me." The guy's just trying to cause trouble. So it was when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel tore his clothes, that he sent to the king saying, "Why have you torn your clothes? Please let me come to him. Please let him come to me, and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel." When Naaman went in with his horses and his chariot, and he stood at the door of Elisha's house. And Elisha sent a messenger to him, maybe Gehazi, saying, "Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored to you, and you shall be clean." Elisha doesn't come out. He doesn't even speak to the guy. Just sends out a message. Maybe it's written out on a blue piece of paper. What's this? "Go wash in the Jordan 7 times. Now, and some have suggested that actually if you look at Leviticus 14, there are some similarities with this, with the ritual for the cleansing of the leper. Maybe that's what it's like an abbreviated version. Verse 11, "But Naaman became furious and went away and said, 'Indeed, I said to myself, he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and heal the leprosy.'" He's expecting the show. You know, I'm paying good money for a show here. I want to see a guy do cartwheels or something. And he just sends me a letter to go take a bath. He says, verse 12, "Are not the Abana and the Pharpar rivers of Damascus better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them to be clean?" So he turned away and went away with a rage. He's thinking, you know, the rivers we got back in Damascus, they're way better than anything these stupid Israelites got. You know, and he's thinking that he's just being told to take a bath. But what God is asking him to do is to trust him and to obey. That's what God's asking him to do. He thinks, "I just want me to take a bath." No, 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 no. You trust God and try doing what he says. And his servants came near and spoke to him and said, "My father, if the prophet had told you to do something great, would you not have done it? How much more than when he says to you, 'Wash and be clean'?" So he went down and dipped 7 times in the Jordan, and according to the saying of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child. And he was clean, like a little child. The language is kind of interesting. He goes down to the Jordan. It's the flesh of a little child. It was a little child that got him to Elisha. And there is kind of an undercurrent here of humility. Humility brings a blessing, my friends. Sometimes we're so puffed up and proud, "I'm not going to do that silly thing." Why not? Why? What's it going to hurt? What's it going to hurt to just believe God once? Peter talks about how we ought to how God resists the proud, gives grace to the humble, and that we ought to humble ourselves under the mighty hand of God. Grace comes from humility, not from pride. Verse 15, "And he returned to the man of God, he and all his aides, and came and stood before him, and he said, 'Indeed, now I know that there is no God in all the earth except in Israel. Now, therefore, please take a gift from your servant.'" He's kind of sounds like he's become a God follower. And he said, this is what Elisha says. He says, "As the Lord lives before whom I stand, I will receive nothing." And he urged him to take it, but he refused. Now, it's not that it's wrong for Elisha to take gifts. We just saw a few minutes earlier how he took this first fruits offering. He received that and then he spread it out to everybody else. It's not wrong for him to receive gifts, but in this instance, absolutely not. He's a brand new believer. "Don't you dare give me a penny. Not a single penny. This guy needs to know that God operates on grace, not money. There's no place for money with this at all. I love that about Elisha. Buddy, don't you try paying me nothing. So Naaman said, then if not, please let your servant be given 2 mule loads of earth, for your servant will no longer offer either burnt offerings or sacrifices to other gods, but to the Lord. In other words, I'm going to take some dirt home with me. That's the beginning of the souvenir industry in Israel. He wants 2 mule loads of dirt so he can build his own little Jewish altar, you know, in Damascus. Yet in this thing, may the Lord pardon your servant when my master goes into the temple of Rimmon to worship there and he leans on my hand and I bow down in the temple of Rimmon. That's the god of Damascus. When I bow down in the temple of Rimmon, may the Lord please pardon your servant in this thing. And he said to him, go in peace. So he departed from him a short distance. It's kind of interesting. He's worried about what's going to happen when my boss takes me to church, to his church. And I know this is not kosher. This is not a good thing. Can I just suggest that we learn to give them time? When a person becomes a new believer, you know what? They're not going to fix everything all at once. Give them some time. Give them some grace. It took you a while to get where you are, didn't it? You know? And when a person comes to know the Lord, you know, slack off a little bit. Give them time. They still need to respond, but give them time to respond. Verse 20. But Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, look, my master has spared Naaman the prophet, this Syrian, while not receiving from his hands what he brought. But as the Lord lives, I will run after him and take something from him. He sounds like a P.T. Barnum. Yeah, sucker's born every minute. We just let a good mark get away. You know, how could he do that? This guy's loaded with dough and we just let him walk out. How could we do that? So Gehazi pursued Naaman. When Naaman saw him running after him, he got down from his chariot to meet him, and he said, is all well? And he said, all is well. My master has sent me, honestly, saying, indeed, just now, two young men of the sons of the prophets have come to me from the mountains of Ephraim. Please give me them a talent of silver and 2 changes of garments. I rethought things, is what Elisha said. A talent of silver, that's 75 pounds of silver. It's about $400,000 worth of silver. And a couple of changes of clothes. But remember, Naaman's brought 10 talents of silver with him. So he's got plenty. So Naaman said, well, don't just 1 talent. I'll give you 2 talents. Because the guy is just so thankful about what God's done. He wants to give 2 talents. And he urged him and bound 2 talents of silver in 2 bags and with 2 changes of garments and handed them to 2 of his servants. And they carried him on him. That's 150 pounds of silver. So he's even got a delivery. I will deliver the silver here for you. And he came to the citadel. They came to the top of the hill. He took them from their hand. Let's not get too close to the boss. You guys can go home. I'll take it from here. And he stored them away in his house and let the men go. And they departed. Now he went in and stood before his master. Elisha said to him, where did you go, Gehazi? And he said, your master did not go, your servant did not go anywhere. Is that knowledge thing is happening. God's been whispering in Elisha's ear. And he said, did not my heart go with you when the man turned back from his chariot to meet you? Is it time to receive money and to receive clothing, olive groves and vineyards, sheep and oxen, male and female servants? Therefore the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and your descendants forever. And he went out from his presence leprous, as white as snow. Because of his greed, Gehazi will become a leper just like Naaman was. We have to guard against greed, beloved. God is not well pleased when people misuse his name for financial purposes. It's the stupidest thing in the world. Why do you do things for people? Is it so they'll pat you on the back? So they'll take you to dinner? So that they'll do something for you? Paul wrote, but those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and harmful lusts which drowned men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. I I guess in a way, it's probably good that God doesn't do the leprosy thing anymore. There'd be a lot of lepers in the ministry, wouldn't there? It's a sad thing that has hit the church. But God help us. God help us not to get so caught up in greed that we miss out on what God is wanting to do. We are done. Let's stand.